This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. At the end of a bad relationship, many people turn to comfort food or bad TV. But Jennifer Vertelin turned to science. She's an animal behavior expert who has spent years studying animals ranging from lemurs to prairie dogs. So she decided to look to the animal kingdom for new insight on dating. Jennifer dug into research about animal behavior and then took her findings out into the world of romance. She approached each new date as if she were an animal trying to find a mate. And she tells her stories in her new book, Wild Connection, What Animal Courtship and Mating Tell Us About Human Relationships. Jennifer's a scholar in residence at Duke University and a research scientist at the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. And she's here with us today. Hi, Jennifer. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. So tell me more about the background. What's behind this book?
Well, I had just finished graduate school and got my PhD and got out of a very bad relationship. And really, one night, just thought to myself, how is it that an expert in animal behavior who studies mating systems in animals, and I can't even figure out how to have success in my own love life. And I thought, I wonder, you know, why we don't see some of the common problems that we have in human relationships in animals. And I thought, maybe if I dove into a little bit more on the animal behavior side of how they work these things out, I could apply that to my own life. And that's really what started the process.
And we got to think, and it may not be true, so I want to ask you what you found, but I guess my intuition is that animals really don't have this problem. They don't run away dejected. They just either, you know, succeed or not and move on or something.
Well, you know, there might be a period of feeling rejected and dejected depending on the situation, but they definitely don't carry it on for years and years. They certainly move on and find a better match for themselves.
And they don't have the easy access to alcohol, that, you know, sort of self-medication. So tell us about the research process.
Well, so what I did is I literally just kind of wrote down all the aspects of animal mating and courtship that I was so familiar with and started thinking about the way animals choose their mates and what's important to them, and then submitted my love life, if you will, to the scientific process and went out on a lot of dates to try to test out some of my ideas.
Did you tell your dates they were part of an experiment?
A lot of them. Yeah. I did. I told them that I had this idea that I was writing this book. In my mind, I was writing this book. And a few of them certainly wanted to know if they were going to end up in the book. Mm-hmm. And I was honest and said, you might be a data point. It really depends on how things go.
From date to data point.
Exactly.
By Jennifer. So we've got the research project. And this is interesting now because you kind of lay it out in the way that animals do this, kind of in chronological order. The first section of the book about first impressions, and they matter across the species, right?
Absolutely. And they matter for us, too. And I think that we have a tendency to try to downplay how important physical appearance or physical attraction actually is to bringing two people together. And it's really a biological force that propels us towards one another, and we can't really ignore how important that is.
And we know a little bit about that. Symmetry, for instance, which we find even across cultures, is something that humans find attractive. Not that superficial. It does point to something biological.
It does. In fact, symmetry can give you an indication of the genetic health of an individual. It can give you information about what might have happened during development for an individual, and those things matter. To us at a really deep biological level when it comes to producing offspring that are the best quality offspring that we can have.
During development, in other words, if there was any kind of interruption, a small infection, the
right.
Symmetry would have been disturbed, and we now know you're a little more susceptible at some root level than a symmetrical phase.
Absolutely.
Wow. So you've got that. So that one we kind of across the board, which is comforting for us. We're not that superficial. There's something about
right.
You know, what we take to be attractive. Then you go beyond that and you talk about deception,
yes.
which is not unique to humans, although we've raised it to an art, haven't we?
We have. And in fact, actually, when it comes to physical appearance, this is an area where we see very little deception in animals and a lot of deception in humans, from fake nails to coloring our hair to fake body parts, makeup, all these things that we actually do that disguise or alter our physical appearance. parents, and I sort of suggest that it might interrupt the process of really being able to find a good mate, because we don't see animals do this. And one of the reasons we don't is that information is so critical for animals when it comes to mate selection that it's almost immune to cheating.
Yeah, but I'm gonna argue with you a little bit. I wanna have a conversation about this, because, for instance, humans do deception in appearance. Well, we use makeup, we coif our hair in a certain way, we wear clothes that are designed to make us more attractive, but that might have a kind of adaptive virtue as well, because for humans, staying alive, survival depends on being part of the group, being accepted, and so therefore being cool or being attracted to the cool person in the group. Does have a kind of physical adaptive value.
Absolutely. And I agree with you. And you do see animals that will use external objects like the splendid fairy wren that brings a feather that highlights the coloring of his feathers and amplifies it. So I think using tools to enhance features we genuinely have is not a bad thing, and it wouldn't qualify as deception. I think that where we get into trouble is if we fundamentally alter either our personality or our physical appearance in order to be accepted, because in the long run, it's not going to be a good strategy. I think we may have all had that experience where we meet someone and maybe we express a little more interest in activities than we genuinely have. And then at some point down the line, there's a conflict because our real personality might emerge, our authentic self emerges, and the person says, wait a minute, who am I with? And animals don't just assess individuals, potential mates on physical appearance. They also use things like personality and compatibility. And those things are really important in long-term relationships.
You even had an experience like that. It wasn't so much the personality. It was just the phony photo.
Yes. Yeah. And I've been on both sides of this. So when I was younger, I absolutely, you know, tried to change my personality to match what I thought somebody would like. And not surprisingly, it didn't turn out really well. And then I was on the receiving end of this sort of thing when I did meet somebody who we were meeting for a date and I didn't recognize the person. They were much older and in much different physical condition than they had represented themselves.
I'm going to quibble on that too, because in the animal kingdom, for instance, when a peacock, any animal, displays or does that little dance that we've all seen on the Discovery Channel or National Geographic, they don't do that all the time. We're only doing that just to get the mate. After that, it's about getting the worms and feeding the
Absolutely. Yes, but the ability to do that dance, and let's say if you're a prairie chicken, for how long you can do that dance, you know, males that can do that dance the most expressively and the loudest and for the longest period of time, even up to 2 months straight, they are displaying a trait of stamina. So the dancing and the prancing, that is a way to display the traits that they authentically have. And females, in this particular case, if we're talking about females, they use that trait. So, for example, cardinals, males that are redder tend to be able to find access to higher quality food, which is what gives them that coloring. They also have fewer parasites. And so a female that chooses a male will make this link unconsciously, of course, that this male is an excellent provider because of the way that he looks.
If I can fake you out and give you a phony personality that gets you to like me, I could win an offer. I could run for president and win, and that would make me a successful guy because I know how to fake people out.
This is true, and I guess we might have to redefine what we call success then in that case.
But let's get back to the animal kingdom. I want to figure out what the adaptive purpose of, for instance, a peacock's feathers. What does that tell the peahen about why this guy is good?
Well, you know, what's really fascinating about this is I think that the peacock's tail has been the iconic symbol of a female choice in the animal kingdom and for ever since the days of Darwin. And, you know, after a lot of investigation and head scratching among scientists, they finally have figured out what is going on. And the reality is that peacock's tails are the way that they are, and they're flashy with all those eye spots simply because females like them. And it turns out that females just really find males that have lots of eye spots super sexy. In fact, those males that have over 150 eye spots are the sexiest of all. And females are not running around counting eye spots. What they are doing is assessing males, and males that have the highest number of eye spots also happen to be the most symmetrical males.
Aha. Uh-huh. So we're back to symmetry. So there is a kind of real biological thing, not just I like them. Because I was going to send you back to the research lab to give me a better answer. Would you read for us a wonderful book? And it's great grist for conversation and contemplation. The book is Wild Connection. Jennifer Vertelin is our guest. And would you read for us?
Sure. Okay. So I will... go to chapter 7, Are We Mating or Dating, to talk a little bit about mating strategies. If I were a 13-lined ground squirrel, my romantic life would be a lot less muddled. For these squirrels, both male and female, it is pretty straightforward. A quick hookup is the only way to go. Males make plugs, there is sperm competition, males and females mate multiply, and once they mate, the females raise the litters, and that's all she wrote. The female and male are not confused. They don't have to think that now, just because they've mated, they are making their way down the aisle with the eyebrow-raising baby bump and the holy crap, what are we doing, look on their faces, joined at the hip for all eternity, destined to find, hide, and share their nuts together forever. We can think of the quick hookup, as practiced by 13-line ground squirrels, as a short-term mating strategy. Meanwhile, the lengthy partnerships of gibbons, geese, and penguins are the models of long-term mating strategies. But are things really this simple? Unlike 13-lined ground squirrels, which only pursue a short-term approach, other species, including humans, combine short- and long-term tactics depending on their agendas. Often, individuals pursue multiple agendas simultaneously. Let's put it this way. While 13-lined ground squirrels get together for a minute, we can get together for 20 minutes, okay, maybe 7, or for a night, a weekend rendezvous, a summer fling, a season, a year, or a lifetime. Among humans, this is truly universal, with different cultures having different words for these types of interactions. Despite all evidence to the contrary, the strong cultural belief that humans, as well as other quote-unquote monogamous species, pursue only one mating strategy continues to persist.
Jennifer Vertelin is the author of Wild Connection, What Animal Courtship and Mating Tell Us About Human Relationships. So let's talk about monogamy for just a minute. Yeah, I mean, there's a clear suggestion that it works for certain reasons, mm-hmm. under certain conditions, and in other conditions, endless philandering might just be the better way to go. Now, species tend to be a little less flexible about that, don't they? Or can they flex according to local conditions?
They absolutely flex according to local conditions. So in a lot of canid species like wolves, there is generally a monogamous pair. However, like in the Ethiopian wolf, when a female is more closely related to her mate, she will actually pursue an additional partner for which to produce offspring with. But she will stay with her current mate. And this is also true in things like tarsiers. If the pair is actually more closely related to one another, they will pursue outside mating opportunities. So there is flexibility. And even within a species, for example, say swans, that we sort of embrace as the icon of monogamy, which they are not, unfortunately, I hate to burst the bubble there, not every individual participates in infidelity.
On the state of things today, we are talking with Jennifer Vertelin. Wild Connection is her book. The program is The State of Things. So, no, swans, when they put their heads together, they make a heart. They have to stay together. Who? And by the way, it's the female that cheats, right?
Oh, almost always.
Is it cheating? I mean, does the male get mad? Will he go after
the... Yes. So it depends on the species. So, for example, in many bird species, probably even swans, although I don't have, the evidence for that in my head right now, but I know in other birds, if the male catches the female mating with other males, he will abandon the nest. Now, what's interesting is that when you have the reverse and females catch the male mating, pursuing other mating opportunities, there's more arguing, if you will. And so it's much riskier for females, actually, because they lose their partner. But when you do the genetics, it turns out that anywhere from, 1/3 to 2/3 of the chicks are not related to her partner.
Do we know when monogamy is useful and when it's not?
Well, I think that sometimes it depends. There can be environmental factors like resource distribution, how resources are available in the environment. And we even see human cultures where, we sort of typically are given the message that males have harems of females, and that's been historically, you know, the mating system for humans. But in fact, there's over 50 cultures where females have multiple husbands. And this has been shown to be linked to the availability of resources in the environment. So that's one factor. There's another factor, genetics, that is showing us that there can be a genetic component to the degree of monogamy that any particular individual actually expresses.
Interesting stuff. You've done the research. It started with a bad romance. So how's your love life after doing the book?
It's interesting. I think it's changed a lot about the way I approach dating and also the way I interact with potential partners. Sometimes in a humorous way, I can't help myself but sit back and wonder what kind of animal am I dealing with, you know? But it also made me really, you know, have to narrow down what is it that I'm offering and what is it that I'm looking for. And then when I'm sitting across from someone on a date, really evaluating what is this person offering to me? What traits do they have? Is it compatible with me? And really help me put also attraction in perspective, because it's not that hard to find someone you're attracted to, but it's incredibly difficult to find somebody you're compatible with.
Well, and when you create that template, things we're looking for, it does show the diversity of me's and I's and authentic I's who have various needs at various times.
Yes.
To be accepted by a larger group, to have affection from a particular individual,
right,
to be a faithful companion in rearing children. Those are all very different values, and not always going to find that same person.
That's right. That's right. And I think also what's changed is that I suggest that it makes it, when you look at things from this perspective, you're much more able to accept what another person is. And even if it doesn't go beyond that one date, there's a more genuine interaction because of where you're coming from.
Great stuff. Very interesting. Jennifer Vertelin, thanks for being on the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jennifer is an animal behavior specialist and the author of the new book, Wild Connection, What Animal Courtship and Mating Tell Us About Human Relationships. She's going to be reading from her book at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh next Thursday, July 31st. You can find out more information about her book and about everything we talk about here on The State of Things at our website, stateofthings.org, a program that's produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, and Will Michaels, with an intern, Charlie Shelton. Robin Copley's the technical director, Brent Wolf is the news director, and North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.